to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. In examining the relationship of stress and trauma to the development of illness, it's important to include stress management and healing modalities. Today, we'll be looking at the role of feeling-based psychological counseling in stress management. Learning to integrate our disparate and sometimes conflicting inner versions of our experiences and communicating fairly to the people nearest to us is sometimes overwhelming, especially when there's an overlay of old trauma. Holding to the truth of our feelings without causing unnecessary pain to others or ourselves is an invaluable goal, although often left behind in order to avoid conflict. Join me in the next hour as I talk with therapists Miriam Redstone and David Dillman about the role of our most difficult feelings in learning to stay present with ourselves and the people close to us. Miriam Redstone and David Dillman are therapists who have been married for 28 years. They work with individuals, couples, and families. Miriam is a licensed clinical social worker and has been a therapist for the last 30 years. She focuses on the feelings which underlay physical, emotional, and spiritual problems and is interested in helping people connect with their inner child using a variety of modalities. The work she does is of a deep nature, and it works best for people who want to stay in contact with themselves and others in a profound and intimate way. David has a master's degree in both recreation and social work. He is currently registered in the state of California as an associate clinical social worker. He began his career more than 30 years ago as a primal therapist, and in subsequent years pursued a variety of other interests. In the past 7 years, he's resumed working as a therapist, both individually and with primarily male clients, and jointly with Miriam, with couples and families. And they live in West Sonoma County, live in practice in West Sonoma County, and they're both sitting here looking like they're experiencing some feelings themselves, having never been on the radio and living in the woods in a quiet place. One of the things that we talked about when we talked to each other a bit about the show is, let me also just explain something. I asked David and Miriam to join me, not because everybody who listens to them today is going to run out and call them and go see them as therapists, although we will give out their phone number and people can go see them if they live close enough to do so. The real reason was to give people some framework for understanding feeling-based therapy so that they can maybe review, if they're thinking of doing counseling on their own, review different styles of therapy and see what feels right to them, and also maybe have some kind of a framework for reviewing their own experience in therapy, whether it's helping them or not. So this is more of an educational sort of thing. Now, one of the things that we talked about in relationship to stress is that stress itself is a feeling. So using that as a beginning, one might say, as you did to me, Miriam, that one of the first things about understanding what it's like to feel your feelings or go into your feelings is to start wherever you are. And if that's stress, to use the body as a ground for understanding, because that's a feeling. Physical feelings are feelings.
Yeah. I could just take 4 a.m. right now being on the radio. When somebody comes in and they breathe into their bellies and it's quiet, it's like, what is your body saying? My body's saying right now, this is scary, being on the radio. Mm-hmm. And usually when somebody comes in, it's something that's repetitive in their life. There's a pattern that's going on. And so in therapy, the work I do is take you back to your child inside. And for me, it's like, what was my child? How did she get scared? What scared her? What was going on? And so there's a sort of a breathing into that child and then hearing what she has to say back.
One of the things that's counterintuitive about doing that is that most people are going to therapy because they're uncomfortable with the feelings they're having. And going to a therapist and having the therapist say, I want you to concentrate on the feelings and feel them, is counterintuitive for most people. They think, no, wrong. I want to get away from the feeling. I don't want to feel the feeling. But there's, I believe very strongly, a reward at the end of a long road of feeling your feelings, and maybe even a more immediate reward. David, do you want to talk about what sorts of things people experience in terms of connecting up, what they're experiencing to, and helping them to become more present in the present, more physically present, more mm-hmm. emotionally present?
Yeah, I think one of the things, if somebody chooses to go into therapy, is that whoever they're working with, there's a sense of safety and a sense that the person that's wanting the therapy feels from the therapist that it's really a safe place to be themselves, to be heard, to that's really a time and a space where they can really share themselves. And I think in the course of a good therapist that listens, the person can, in the course of just talking initially, begin to cover things that really are true and important for them, and that may include physical symptoms or sensations, and it may include feelings. And part of the work that we do is to really honor and focus on those parts of the body that there's discomfort or hurt or pain or whatever, and to really focus on those feelings that are upsetting for that person.
So, Miriam, so just like an example of what we're talking about is in a nice, quiet, your practice is that you guys live in the woods, so you have this lovely, quiet little office, and somebody comes in, and they're there, and they know they're suffering, they know they don't feel good, they know that things are going on, but maybe a way to start is for them to literally, like we were talking about in the show with Darlene Cohn, literally start with where is their breathing, and is it shallow, and is it stuck? And instead of just noticing that, what happens? How do you go more deeply? How do you do that? How do you go more deeply?
Well, people come in, usually they have a story. They're hurting because of something that's happened in their life. So they'll start with their story, and then I usually say, if you can just take a breath into your belly, there's a feeling underneath that story. And usually the story has been repetitive enough in their life that they know the feeling. They might not be able to label it, but they know the feeling. And they start saying the feeling. And then I will probably say, does that feel familiar to you? And usually it does. And we see how far back it can go. And it can usually go back to childhood. And it's a relief for people. Once they connect up with their child and that feeling, it is such a relief because it's got a name, it's got a memory, there's somebody there that's hearing them. And the person that's the most important hearing them is themselves. So they're connecting with their own child. And it's the first time for a lot of people that their child has been heard. And really, the first person that's really hearing them is the person themselves.
I think it's a very powerful thing for a person to be seen. What I observe in my own practice is that when people come in and they begin to talk about the ways that they feel unwell physically, sometimes you can see that they're really suffering, that they're in a lot of pain. So I'll stop them and I'll say, how are you feeling right now? And there'll be this, you know, they'll just burst into tears. And they mm-hmm. have no idea where the tears came from. And in some cases, people will actually say to me, oh, I don't want to go. I feel like it's too much self-pity. Mm. Which always makes me terribly sad. Mm-hmm. Because what it means is that no matter what age, I mean, essentially, this work in a way, I mean, we're not, the people have read, I think a lot of people have read inner child work. They've read John Bradshaw's work and stuff. And there's a way in which your work is similar to that. There's a way in which your work is similar to primal therapy. It's an amalgam of different styles. You have your own style. But one of the things that I notice that's very difficult and very brittle for adults in pain is giving some kind of attention and compassion and sympathy, some real compassionate sympathy toward the part of them that's immature still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really true, and I think part of it's cultural. There's just very little support out there to explore feelings, and I think all of us, as little boys and little girls, get the message from our parents and from the culture that we're to spend very little time on these kinds of feelings of hurt, anger, fear, sadness. And that happens so over and over and over that we incorporate a value judgment about ourselves that we are not worth the time to explore these feelings.
Yeah, the attention, yeah. Let's go back to this issue of how it changes things for the present. How does, I mean, part of what you're saying, Miriam, is that there's a sense, the tremendous sense of relief. It's like they let go of something. Their breathing deepens when they start crying. I observe this, you observe this. We've experienced it ourselves. You finally let go. It's like some big burden that you've been feeling and you've been holding. And there's a sense of release in that sense. But there's also a very profound thing that happens when you and another person accept and recognize something that hasn't been seen, that's been kept secret, some profound hurt that's been kept secret.
Well, one of the things that happens is there's these connections. For example, when I first started, I remember I went back to being a baby, and I remember I was crying all the time, and my parents saying, "What's the matter? What's the matter?" And I would go, "What's the matter? What's the matter?" And then all of a sudden, this connection was like a lightning bolt. Said, "You're what's the matter? You're not paying attention to me. I'm not getting seen. I feel like an outcast." And what it did is it generalized so that a lot of things started turning inside out. You know, there was nothing the matter with me. I was an okay person.
As a baby, you're saying?
As a baby. Mm-hmm. And what it did is, my adult hearing that, then as I went out into the world, I felt more okay. I mean, when that connection happens between the adult and the child, it is so profound, and it generalizes. It's not like you have to go back and re-experience every single thing that your parents did. There's a lot of generalization that happens to the child in the patterning.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is that it's rather daunting for people to think, every uncovered, frightening memory I've ever had, I need to go back, and I'm going to have to re-experience those things, and it's going to re-traumatize me. And from the standpoint of health, re-traumatizing somebody isn't necessarily the right way to deal with trauma. I mean, there are people who specialize in trauma, post-traumatic stress, prenatal stress and trauma, people who have experienced things that happened before they were born in utero and stuff like that. There's been proof that there really is this thing. And one of the tricky parts is to not re-traumatize the person. And the way that you do that, I think, you tell me if you agree that this is so, is that you create a strong container for the part that's sensitive and hurt by having that part have voice so that the adult begins to uncover what's at the bottom of why they feel a lack of compassion, why they feel a brittleness, why they feel so brittle toward other people, in fact, is because there's a breach, there's a disconnect. And when they reconnect with the part that's little and that's hurt, there's a kind of wellspring of creativity and compassion that can come out of that. And it doesn't require necessarily that you go back over every single traumatic experience. But as you're saying, there's a tone to the family and a tone to whether or not you felt accepted. Even if the family appeared on the surface to be normal, mm-hmm. it may not have felt so to the child. And that child's still inside every adult.
Right. And one of the things as the therapist is to talk to the child. And so I'm sort of teaching the person that's come how to speak to their child. So I'll say, I want to talk to your child here. And I want to tell your child that she's in a very safe place, that I really want to hear what she has to say, that everything she has to say is important, and that her perspective is the truth for her. And at the beginning, usually a lot of the anger and sadness is at the parents and the family situation. But as you do a little therapy, you come to see that you yourself, the adult, has become the judge and is the one that is putting the child down. So that the relationship really becomes stronger as you go on with yourself rather than with your parents. And it's not a blaming kind of situation.
You know, another way to describe this, and David, you may have encountered this in your work too, is that there's been research that shows that people who have been tortured or abused, even as an adult, sometimes identify a kind of start to identify or relate to the torturer or the person, because they're helpless and they feel helpless and they feel like they're going to be killed if they're not. So they start identifying and thinking that person actually is strong, and sometimes even fall in love with that person. Mm-hmm. And that's very similar to what happens to children and families. They can't disconnect. Children die if they feel that there's nothing there for them. They have to feel some connection, so they maladapt. And part of the maladaption is to internalize those values. You know, so if you've got a parent who very casually, without realizing the power of what they're saying, says something like, you know, you're too fat, or why do you act like that, you stupid, you're never going to amount to something. They're angry at that moment. They think they're just discharging some emotion. They're nice to the kid later, but the kid really hears that stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's a form of trauma. And then that voice becomes an internalized voice.
I think that's exactly right, yeah. And I think at those moments when the child hears that coming towards them and they feel hurt and maybe confused and not deserving of that, because there's not support for that feeling kind of is put aside. And if there's a lot of incidences like that, those feelings separate from our consciousness. And so I think as grown-ups, whereas it feels initially intimidating to go into therapy and quote-unquote go back and feel those feelings, because it's been so long since we've felt those feelings and because they felt so painful at the very beginning, we kind of feel that it's a fact that to go back there will be maybe too painful, counterproductive, whatever. But one of the things about this work is that what we sometimes think are facts, as we go back and feel those feelings, we're amazed mm-hmm. that, my God, I can feel that feeling and survive.
Yeah, and also understand who you are in a different way. I mean, do one of you want to give an example of how that might work, maybe even from one of your clients without identifying them? Like, what sorts of confused realities do people have about themselves? I mean, I can do it if you don't want to, but I'd rather you used your own. I mean, the example that comes to my mind is somebody who's very attractive. They think they're ugly and fat, for instance. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of that. Very lovely people, very attractive women. Sometimes men, too. They think they're stupid. They think they're this or that. And when they reconnect with that childhood place and they get to feel how lovely that child was, they stop seeing themselves in through the mm-hmm. eyes of their parents.
Yeah, it's just, it's pretty amazing and it's pretty powerful. And I just can't stress the importance enough of the fact that those early feelings that we all have as kids have really strong impacts on us.
I think the most profound thing is that we find out as adults that the kid really knew what was going on. No matter what anyone said in the family, the kid actually knew what was real. You go back to those feelings and you go, wow, I really knew what was up.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing that happens is very early on, most of us in our family situation think this is not working. And I think we do some of our most creative development, and we create a personality that's going to fit in. It might be
yes.
rebellious, but we each are different in what we create, and it is very unique.
We each have roles in the family, is what you're saying. We have jobs.
In the family. And a lot of times the roles have nothing to do with who we are in our beings as a child. And one of the things that I notice a lot, because I work with a lot of women, is abuse. When you're yelled and screamed at, or if you're hit and you're constantly put down, you, as a child, you think it's your fault. I mean, you hear that all the time in divorce. The children always think that it's their fault. And as a child, you think that everything's your fault. And we tend to repeat the patterns of childhood. So you're going to get yourself in relationships that are abusive. And until you start feeling your child, ow, this hurts, I'm hurting, the pattern just keeps repeating.
Yeah, it really
Once
does.
You feel that you're hurting and your adult sees that your child is hurting, you don't want to be in that situation anymore.
That's right.
And so there's a connection between the adult and child. And for most of the people that I've worked with, when that connection happens, the behavior in the present really shifts.
I just want to ID the show. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm in studio with David Dillman and Miriam Redstone, who are therapists in Westonoba County, and we're talking about feeling-based therapy. today. One of the things, there are psychological terms that get connected to things. And there's a term that gets bandied around a lot, and people don't understand what it means, and it's important. It's called narcissism. Everyone thinks narcissism is where people are so in love with themselves that they can't see past their own nose, and they're just basking in their own beauty. That's not what narcissism means. What narcissism, from a psychological standpoint, means is that you think everything's about you. So if you're close to another person and they're having a bad day, it's about you. And often what happens is that a lot of us have been raised by parents who are narcissistic, who really never separated from us. They never really felt that we were separate people. They still see us as part of themselves. And so any insecurities or angers or discomfort that they have about themselves, they pass on to you. That's also a form of narcissism, where you don't see a separation between you and other people, and you think everything is about you. That's narcissism. And one of the things that I think changes when you connect with deep, early, kind of essential feelings that are coming from a part of you that's immature and maybe even has thoughts and feelings that for adults seem inappropriate somehow, like, you know, really angry at someone or something, you think, well, there's an honesty to those feelings, and when you feel those feelings, you tend to blame other people less for your feelings. You tend to be able to see where your own feelings are getting triggered. And as you've said so many times, Miriam, when somebody has a really over-the-top reaction, they go, wow, that made me angry. Whoa! That's usually because it's triggering some very, very old thing from your childhood that was habituated, that was a pattern. Mm-hmm. So it frees you up.
One of the things that comes to mind is, for myself as a young boy, one of the feelings I used to feel was confused.
Yes.
And I remember there's a picture of my mother and my father, and, well, actually there's a picture of me when I was real little, and I was looking out, and there was a real look of confusion on my face. So one of the things that stays with me growing up is kind of an insecurity and a level of confusion about what is it that I need to do, should be doing. And that in and of itself can become so powerful in my day-to-day life that is a very subtle form of narcissism, because I am living totally within my own kind of...
You're stuck.
Yeah, I'm stuck in this story of how.
And also that you're responsible for doing something that's going to make things either all right or not all right. Mm-hmm. That it's all about what you do instead of that other people are separate. Because it's lonely that other people are separate. Nobody, you don't actually want to feel that so much as
right.
a child. You'd rather feel a sense of connection. And if you can't get a healthy sense of connection, you get an unhealthy sense of connection, which is everything is about me and I'm responsible for everything that happens here.
So just to kind of finish that point, what I was thinking was that people say, well, you know, if you're going to therapy and you're just spending all this time on yourself, well, we spend a lot of time on ourselves just in the course of the way we negotiate through our days, working out our own way of looking at the world.
So what you're saying is that not connecting up to things and letting go of things and having things settle into ourselves is a lot of work, and it takes up a lot of our time and attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I see what you're saying. Do you have a sense of what's different for you in the way that you work with people from, say, John Bradshaw or even really classic primal therapy? Do you have any sense of do you feel that you've needed to adapt or change any of those ideas?
When I go into a session, I try to be really centered with myself, and I go into a very deep place. And so how I am during that session, I never know ahead of time. There's nothing prepared. That's why doing a radio show is sort of like, oh my goodness.
I understand.
There's preparation. And it's just a sense of being present, because I am going to be with another person in the deepest, most truthful way possible. And so I go in with an open heart, open belly, and just loving. So I don't really... It's hard for me to think, what do they do? That's just
different.
What I do.
That's what you do. And truthfully, I have to say, my observation after having spent most of my life in and out of therapy and studying it and stuff is that a therapist will only take you as far as they've gone themselves. So there are many people who have studied psychological theory and who've gone to school and have become licensed and have worked who haven't done a lot of deep inner work themselves. In fact, I see them sometimes in my practice because they're so disconnected that they begin to develop some real problems physically. And it's an interesting problem because there is this concept of neutrality in therapy. You do want to remain, to whatever degree that you can, neutral so that there's infinite amount of room in the therapy session for the client to formulate and understand their own feelings so that you're not overlaying your ideas on them. But going in and being open and, in other words, another way of saying this too, I think, is that people bring, first of all, the therapist has to be able to go the distance. And not all therapists are capable because they haven't done it in their own lives. The other side of it is that the client has to be able to bring themselves to the situation. And that's going to be whether they feel safe. But it also means that the person really has to. And there's a misunderstanding, I think. People think that when they go to a counselor, one sort or another, they're there to be fixed. And they forget that if they don't really bring themselves to the session with an open heart, like you said, and an open breathing, nothing's going to happen.
It's not at all about being fixed in therapy. It's about opening up to yourself and to your vulnerability. And opening up to that place inside of you that is quiet, and or maybe it's screaming, you know, maybe not be quiet, but that place in you that allows for shift. And it's really opening up to process, not outcome, because it's a learning of a process in therapy that you take out into the world.
That's right. Yeah, so that if you find yourself in crisis again, you have the tools.
Right.
And you also have a relationship. You actually have a dialogue between you and the part of you that's vulnerable and immature.
Exactly.
We're going to have to take a really brief break, just like a 30, 35-second break. And we will be right back. I'm live in the studio. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm live in the studio with David Dillman and Miriam Redstone, who are therapists in West Sonoma County. And we're talking about feeling-based therapy with an eye toward alleviating, to some degree, stress-related illness. We're talking about opening up a dialogue between you and your own heart. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Feels like home. Feels like home to me. Feels like I'm on the way back where I come from. Feels like home to me. Feels like home to me. Feels like I'm on the way back where I.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. I'm live in the studio with Miriam Redstone and David Dillman, who are two therapists in Sonoma County, and we're talking about feeling-based therapy and sort of inner child work a little bit. Did you want to give out a contact number to people?
Yeah.
If they want to contact you?
They can reach us at, we're in West Sonoma County, at 707-874-2350. And I guess I just want to preface it a little bit by saying that it really is feeling work. So it's not an intellectual exercise. And I think it's really, the work that we do is really helpful if you're in your feelings and you might not know what they are, you might feel overwhelmed, you're hurting, you're angry. I think this is the kind of work that can be helpful to people.
Okay. And the number again is 707-874-2350. I might also mention that people will often be tempted to contact someone who's been on the show for referrals. I don't think that would be appropriate, really. I mean, they're not a referral source. The reason that we wanted to do this show was for you to hear a dialogue between me and some people who have some experience in this field about what this form of therapy is like and how it works to alleviate the kind of of hard, rigid, kind of crusty thing that happens to people when they aren't able to feel their own suffering, and how they disconnect from themselves and everybody that's close to them, and how that can form terrible feelings of helplessness and cause lots of illness and stuff. I guess, you know, the question that comes up for me here, and I should mention that if people miss part of today's show and want to get a copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, or if you want to contact me, you can call my information number 24 hours at 707-874-2772. There are people, you mentioned that this kind of work is best for people who are already having a lot of feelings and they just have no idea what's going on, and they're suffering, they don't know why. What about people who have experienced terrible trauma? What about trauma recovery? What about post-traumatic? People have this term now. Everybody's heard this term, post-traumatic stress, which I think is, people don't really understand what that means, but they know they've been the victims of trauma, either recently or in childhood. And there are people who have, like, panic disorders. So, you know, it's kind of counterintuitive for someone who feels so on the edge, feels like they're hanging on to their sanity, to say, well, we just need to go into your feelings. Do you work with people who are in that situation? I would think that it would work quite well for them.
Just to give an example, I have a client who took a walk, and she just collapsed. She just went into a huge panic just being outside. And we just sat on the ground, and she got into the feelings of what she was feeling. And it lasted probably about 20 minutes. And she came out, and we were able to finish our walk. And she was amazed that the feeling, she went into it, and then it was relieved. It's going into the feeling that relieves it. It's pushing it away is the thing that keeps the panic going.
Seems so, except that it's the usual kind of standard of care kind of garbage. I say garbage because of the term standard of care. I don't like that term, but the standard of care is with panic disorders to not feel the feelings, to reframe it mentally, to do cognitive work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think for some people that really works. I mean, different things work for different people. I have trouble dealing with working with people that are on medication because they tend to be split from their child, and they're doing more cognitive work. And it doesn't, in my practice, I don't feel very helpful because I really need to have that contact with the child.
Believe me, there are people on medication who are still in contact with their feelings. Yeah, no, I see them. They still are. It's just that they're trying to hold down a job and not be crying all the time.
No, I'm not. There's no...
No. I know you're not judging. You're just saying that's your experience.
Mm-hmm.
David, when we were talking, one of the things that you were interested in, and we posed the question of whether it was different for men and women, whether there's a difference in this, one of the things that came up was the issue of shame. This is something that John Bradshaw writes a lot about very well, too. But you've had your own, you're talking about it from your own experience as a therapist. You said something very interesting. You said as soon as a child separates from the family as a young adult, it's the shame that re-glues the new person together. And I thought that was really interesting. You said the top layer is sort of untouchable. You want to talk about that a bit?
Yeah.
How shame does that?
Well, just from my perspective, I was rereading John Bradshaw's book, Healing the Shame That Binds You, and I think shame is really an important feeling, and I don't think of it that much. I don't deal with it that much in my work as a therapist, but lately I've been thinking a lot more about it, in part because some issues have come up for myself where I could just feel within myself, geez, I have a lot of shame. And the context with which I would put that would be, years ago, a man that I know told me something that I wrote down because I thought it was really profound. And he said that he thinks the basis of a lot of what we all go through is hurt. And that sadness is hurt that doesn't go away. Fear is anticipation of hurt. And anger is separation of hurt. And I think as young beings, when there is such an incredible We're just kind of just basic, innocent kids, at the, you know, real young. And when there's a lot of hurt, sadness, fear, and anger, and we cannot understand it, and it seems to be directed towards us, we take it personally. And the way John Bradshaw described it is we actually disown ourselves. And we come up with a new formulation that basically says, I'm fundamentally flawed.
Well, you also, don't you reinvent the... You make a new persona for yourself that
yes.
seems more acceptable.
Yes, and as Miriam was saying earlier, that's we all do that, and we all do that incredibly creatively, and we all do that terrifically, and bless us for doing that because it's the way that we survive and negotiate. It's wonderful that we do that, and we're but as we grow older, those patterns and attitudes and feelings don't serve us as well.
They become, I think, brittle. And I think they interfere with our ability to relate to each other, aside from relating to ourselves. I mean, one of the things we're talking about is you're boiling in a pot of water and it's hot and you don't know how to get out. And what Miriam seems to be saying is sometimes you really have to feel how hot it is in there before you can get out of the pot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you feel trapped until you can feel really what you're truly feeling. And that gives you sort of the legs to take care of yourself.
You know, one of the things that happens that people nowadays say that they don't feel passion and they don't feel juice and they feel sort of dead and they're just, things are boring. And I really feel that a lot of that is because they're out of touch with their feelings.
Yeah, you bet.
And it's the feelings that give us our power. And when I connect with my little girl and I'm one being, I'm much more powerful than when I'm disconnected and lost. And I think in families, when we see families, you can really see how people play different roles. They have different patterns that each follow. And one of the things that happens is that we project onto the other what we're feeling. And one of the wonderful things about family therapy is that as each person owns what they're feeling, there's a chance for intimacy. Because each person is going inside and really listening to what they're saying themselves and what the other is saying. And that's what feelings, if you...
Yeah, I want you to unpack that a little more, though, because this is very, very important. Can you give an example of how this works with, say, spouses or domestic partners? It's well, that sort of he said, she heard, he heard, she said kind of...
Well, I mean, one of the things in our relationship, we've been together a long time, and at the beginning, and for a lot of women, it's like we want more attention. I mean, women tend to want to be heard and touched and nurtured, and...
They want to connect.
They want to connect. And one of the biggest turning points in our relationship was when I realized that I wasn't doing that with myself.
Right.
Was not listening to myself. The things, the very things I was asking David for were the very things that I needed for myself, from myself. So in relationships, it tends, the person that is saying to the other person, you're not da-da-da, is usually what that person is not giving to themselves. And it is incredibly profound.
I want you also, I'm going to want you to sort of say this thing from the male perspective, but before we skip over, tell me the thing, when we reconnected, we knew each other when we were like in our 20s, and then we reconnected recently, and you said something so wonderful to me about how you care for the part of you that's little. Tell me what you said. You remember the thing about what you tell your little girl that I'm...
Well, when my little girl is hurting and my adult knows exactly what she's feeling, I'm the only one. I am the only one that knows what she is feeling. And when I give that to myself, because in the adult world, sometimes I'm feeling that same feeling. So we connect because we're feeling the exact same feeling. And to get heard, for my little girl to know that there is somebody now that knows exactly what life is like for her is so powerful. It has changed me forever.
And the idea, too, that you're not going to abandon her, that you're
Absolutely.
Really there, that
mm-hmm.
there's someone there who gets it, who
mm-hmm.
really knows what this pain is about
Absolutely.
And isn't leaving, is really staying there. And that, what you said to me and what I think I'm beginning to experience, too, is that as the child in you begins to feel that there is somebody there, and this is similar to Bradshaw's work too, that there's a new parent on the block, that there's a new sheriff in town, and that this parent is going to parent in a more loving, more compassionate, more open-ended way, more accepting way, and an actual unconditional way, the child stops acting up so much. Because one of the fears that we have as adults is that if you go into these feelings, you're just not going to be able to do your job. And you were saying, well, sometimes, you know, I had another therapist years ago who was very valuable to me say, you can put your stuff in a little box, in a beautiful little box, and put it on the shelf and say, I'm going to reopen this box when I get home from work. And so you said, say to your child, I'm going to go now. I'm going to do some stuff because we have to take care of our life here. When I come back, we'll spend some time together.
I mean, as a parent, you do that with your children. I mean, hopefully. You know, you cannot always be there for your child. And so you say, I can't be here at this moment. I will be back, you know, and I say when, and we'll resume. And you can say that to your child, your inner child. If you don't talk to your inner child, that child is center stage and is crying and screaming louder and louder until we pay attention.
Well, and developing eating disorders and addictions and all kinds of things to comfort yourself.
Absolutely.
So from the male standpoint, you know, Miriam's just talked about the women. And we're not saying that all women and all men are exactly the same as Miriam and David, but I would bet that they're similar and that there are patterns that we see over and over again. There are a lot of books written about this, too.
Mm-hmm.
So what pattern do you see men get into?
Well, for myself, when we first got together years ago, I was a pretty outwardly directed place in my life, and Miriam began to talk about feelings and her parents and ways in which her needs didn't get met. And I remember kind of saying, gee, that's too bad. I never had parents like that.
My parents were fine.
Yeah.
I'm a happy guy.
Yeah.
That's what guys say. They say, I'm a happy guy.
Yeah.
So I hear this dun, 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 dun. Yeah.
So in the course of our relationship, our intimate relationship, you know, here's two people, a man and a woman, going head-to-head right with each other, and I was forced to have to start looking internally, and it was very difficult. And I, a lot of times, did not know what was going on with me. And
what was the downside to that? Because you thought you were a happy guy. So what was the downside to that?
The downside, I'm not sure.
To not really being in contact with yourself.
Just not feeling good. Okay. I mean, the downside is I'm living my life, but I'm not feeling
good.
So
you had a kind of covert depression, which is
probably
what Terrence Real talks about, yeah.
But you see, as a guy, you can't admit that.
No.
I mean, so I guess my next comment would be that I think, you know, like I was saying earlier, if hurt and anger and fear and sadness are a part of our lives, one of the things little boys learn early on is that hurt, sadness, and fear are no-nos. Anger is okay. You can't get real angry as a kid, but you can be tough, and that's, as a matter of fact, what you can be. So what I think little boys learn to do, and I learned this, was to disassociate from those feelings. But you don't get away scot-free. I think they stay in my case and other people's cases too, our body. So when women want intimacy, particularly if they want intimacy physically, one of my beliefs is that men can have trouble cuddling and staying in close physical proximity without necessarily having sex or after sex, that prolonged contact with them bodily touches and re-stimulates painful feelings.
Really sad, lonely places.
Really sad, lonely, whatever places. And I think part of the work that can be done is a process of reconnecting our minds with our body.
Mm-hmm. Well, I never think that they were really separated, but we do this disconnect with our feelings and go to safe places. And I think, I mean, I've seen this reversed. I've seen men who are much more feeling-based, and they're in relationships with women who are much more cut off and don't want to feel their feelings. And sometimes it can work out, and sometimes it can't. Sometimes people can make a whole out of two funny parts too, which is a little weird, but they'll, you know, like one person's really positive, the other's really negative, and but they have to stay together. You know, the other person has to feel that, has to balance the other side. And one of the advantages to this kind of work is that you can begin to own your own feelings and have your own sense of things, and you don't have to you don't need the other person to be positive or to be negative or to be this or to be that, because you're more of a whole person coming into a relationship with another whole person, which is sounds very idealistic, but I think that romantic love in our culture is based on the idea of surrender. And surrender, in some sense, when you're really close to somebody, you really love them, and you make a commitment, there's a degree of surrender. On the other hand, you don't surrender your heart and soul in the sense that you give it up or you don't have access to it yourself, because then you become this kind of empty hole that the other person has to fill. And as you were saying, then you're constantly projecting. Do you understand what I'm saying about the tension between surrender? I mean, sex in a way is surrender too. Really good sex is a form of surrender.
Well, if you're going to surrender and really be open, you have to be feel totally safe,
right,
and trusting. Otherwise, maybe you're setting up some kind of familiar drama that,
yes,
you had as a child. And we choose stories, and what I mean by stories, we choose paths in our life that recreate our old feelings so that we can have them.
Well, I think we also do that because we hope that we'll go back and this time it'll work.
Yeah.
This time we'll find somebody who is doesn't pay attention to us in the way that we want, but this time they're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to change them. That's what women do. And we're going to, this person's, I'm going to change this person.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to let people know you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm in the studio with Miriam Redstone and David Dillman, who are therapists in West Sonoma County. They are here talking about feeling-based therapy and the ways in which being in contact with your feelings actually maybe counterintuitively, but actually reduces stress. One of the interesting things that happens when people in very intimate relationships talk to each other is that there's a way of talking that opens things up for people so that they don't get defensive. So here you are, you have a load on, and you want to share this with the other person, but you don't want to blame them, so you use I messages. Well, my observation is that everybody, you know, all of us who have like read lots of books on therapy and done lots of therapy, and then we come into the situation and we're not going to subject the other person to our bad feelings. We're going to do this thing of being really therapeutic, and we're going to use I messages. And so we do this thing. And one thing that's happening is that we're not really letting ourselves feel really what we're feeling. And the other thing we're doing is we're using I messages, and underneath it, there's this feeling that's coming through to the other person, even though you're using I messages. So talk a little bit about what really has to be going on in order for those I messages to be useful. You know, because the other I could just, you know, women think, well, I didn't say, you know, you blah, 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 and he still got upset with me and got defensive.
Well, I think if you're really clear about what you're feeling and you really know that you're, say, angry at your partner, and you say, you know, I'm really angry about this. One of the things that's helpful, because it's very direct. A lot of times, from my experience, people will say I was very direct and I gave an I message, but in fact it wasn't an I message.
For example?
How could you have done that to me? I mean, that might be one. But the other thing that's really important with anger that I have learned for myself, and I think it's helped other people too, is that underlying anger a lot of times is hurt.
Very much.
And I always used to think that anger was the be-all and end-all of feelings, particularly as a guy. And I have come to believe that underlying the times that we're angry, a lot of times we've been hurt. So if I'm really angry at somebody, I can say, and the reason I'm so angry is 2 minutes ago when you said so-and-so, my feelings really got hurt. So I've just shared my truth with that person. Now the other person can come back and state where they're at.
Yeah, and the difference in the language that you just used, the difference is it sounds similar to how could you have done that to me, but it's different. What you said is, I feel hurt and I am angry. And you know, and you haven't made assumptions about what the other person intended. And that's the problem, is this issue of intention, because we don't really know what the person intended. It may be that they really did make a giant mistake, or that they were angry too, and that they really did mean to hurt us. But what I'm learning is that when you really stick to the feeling, even to the extent of just saying, oh, God, I'm so hurt, I feel so hurt, and even crying, that it kind of melts the other person. It kind of gets the other person to really get back on their own seat.
Well, the other person isn't responsible, so then you can listen. Like, you know, in our relationship, if I've, you know, say to David, I'm just on his case, you know, for 5 minutes or so, and he'll go, what are you feeling? What's up? And then that gives me the opportunity to get into what I'm feeling. And it usually has nothing to do with him. You know, it might start there, but as soon as he says, what are you feeling? Or my daughter, if she's really hurting, and this is wrong, and this is wrong, and this is wrong about us, and I go, God, you seem to be having a really hard time. And bingo, she is in her feelings. And we're getting to what is really important.
And what's important about that is that that's where people connect. Because when you really see someone suffering, you're not angry at them anymore.
Right.
You want to be nice to them.
Right, because you love them.
Yeah. You really and you reconnect with the own part of yourself,
mm-hmm,
that's suffering.
Absolutely.
Too.
Mm-hmm.
I had something in mind to go to next, and it disappeared out of my brain because that was kind of moving to talk about. You've talked about the fact that when you're a parent, I mean, never mind even men and women together, or women and women together, or men and men together, intimate, one-on-one domestic partner type relationships, but then you bring a child into the equation. Mm-hmm. And there's another concept from psychotherapy, which is object constancy, which is that children need a sense of consistency or constancy. If things are too crazy-making, if there's too much of a sense that the parent is disappearing and will never come back, or you might be really seriously hurt, it causes all kinds of maladaptations and even death in early childhood with children because it's too traumatic. So object constancy, something they studied where they took away baby monkeys from their mommies and gave them rags, dolls to hold, but they had object constancy with the rag doll, so it worked out. You know, there's this important concept. But this is very hard to do with human beings because, as you said, sometimes mommy or daddy have to go out and the kid doesn't want them to go. And the answer isn't not to go. The answer is to somehow communicate that you really are going to be back. Do you want to talk about some of the challenges of being a parent and being in your feelings?
It's very challenging. It's very challenging to allow your child to have their feelings. And as they get older, the feelings are spoken louder and much more coherently and much more heartfelt in terms of dialogue. And what we did with our daughters, we started a charter school, and the whole concept of it was how to say what you feel what you're feeling, say what you're feeling, and how to be heard. That was the curriculum. And we did it for about 4 years, and it was all the families got involved. And you really have to stop. If you really are going to have a commitment to yourself and your feelings, a lot of times that is what is the most important as a parent. So if my daughter's really in a feeling and she was flipping out about me going out, I would stop and be there with her. It passes. You know, she's not being left alone. She's being left with somebody else, but she's got a feeling about it. So a lot of times you stop, and I do give up what my plan might have been for that moment because I want her to know that she is important. Her feelings are important, and my feelings are important.
What do you do if it makes you angry?
When she does something that makes me angry?
No, or if you really were on a track and you were really racing out the door and suddenly she pulls you back and it makes you angry, how do you handle that? Because I would think that would be the first place that a parent would go.
Well, one of the things that, I mean, this is potentially an extreme case, but we used to drop our daughter off at our neighbor's and she wouldn't come home with us when we want her to come. And I used to pick her up and she'd be screaming and crying and I'd physically pick her up and carry her home.
Right.
And I just have to say, I'm sorry, you know, I mean, that's, but you're coming home, we told you, and now it's time, and that's...
It's like leaving is a part of coming, I mean, there's, it's a cycle.
Yeah, but in yourself, what do you do when you feel angry? And you're, do you just say, this is making me angry?
Yes.
Yeah. Because that's, I think, one of the big problems that we all had as children, is that our parents so profoundly didn't feel that it was appropriate to have any kind of... They were supposed to behave a certain way. So there's this problem in society with people still to this day about the appropriateness of their feelings.
We did a workshop a number of years back with a woman down in Big Sur who ran a program for preschoolers. It was kind of experimental. And we went down for some workshops. And the first day we went down there, there was kids that were fighting, four-year-olds fighting. And that night we asked her, how come these kids are fighting? What's up? She said, we allow fighting here.
Ooh.
As long as the kids are the same age... basically the same age, the same size, and both kids are willing. The only ground rule was that if one of them wants to stop, that's it. The fighting stops. And she said the reason we do that is because in our culture, we never allow anger to be explored. We stop it immediately because we have to be nice. We have to be polite. So we have no experience of beginning to kind of stretch and feel what anger is. So I thought that was really interesting.
Boy, I wonder what they learned from that. I wonder if they actually saw it evolve into hurt.
I would bet they did. I mean, in our charter school one time, we tried that with two kids, and they decided not to fight.
Right.
But invariably, when kids were wanting to fight, one of them was feeling hurt about
something.
Yeah,
you bet. And you, this is a repeat of something you said earlier, but I want to make sure it got through. You said... You've been saying that men have a tendency, maybe even faster than women, to go immediately from hurt to anger because they're not supposed to say, you've hurt my feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Not supposed to admit that kind of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. So you go right to anger. And this is very confusing for women because it's like, what happened? What did I say that was so terrible? And the man is furious and he's walking away. But... most men don't even realize that, and they have to kind of stop and ask themselves, wow, what just I am feeling hurt. I feel hurt. You know, like if a man feels that you don't respect his knowledge or his capacity or his ability or his productivity, thank you, then he might feel this kind of sense of hurt, but he goes right to anger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We just don't have any... go ahead.
Reason for men when they get in touch with their little boys that they can go, my little boy's hurting. I mean, and then they go back to those memories of what happened, that they had to store that away.
And then, of course, the really, as we really have to stop, but the really challenging thing also is when you're with another person that you care about very deeply. You're with a partner or a child, and both of you are little. That's very difficult. And just in closing, what's your advice there?
Don't make big decisions. If you're both in your children, don't make big decisions. Just stay with your child. But don't go, I'm not doing this anymore, and I'm out of here.
Okay. You know. Good. Sounds great. Thank you so much for spending the time here today talking about this. Miriam Redstone, David Dillman, are therapists in West Sonoma County. Their phone number is 707-874-2350. 874-2350, and they do not have a long list of referrals to other therapists. They do not have a book. They came here today to have a conversation for you to hear in order to give yourself some sense of what this kind of therapy might be like, to see if you want to explore this and you want to find, because you can evaluate a therapist by talking to them about whether they do this kind of work. They are available if you live someplace you want to, but please don't call them and ask them for referrals. That's just not fair. I had to drag them in here. So, thank you all for listening today, and I want to remind you that I'm Lena Berman, and if you need more information or you want a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours. That's 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.com. Next week, the first of two Pledge Drive shows. Learn how to end your addictions with nutrients and supplements. My guest will be researcher and physician, actually psychiatrist, Dr. Charles Gant, G-A-N-T, author of End Your Addictions Now. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness at the Sebastopol side is George Curtis. Thank you to Johnny Otis in the Powerhouse, and at KPFA, Sally Phillips. I'm Lena Berman. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced live by Free Speech Radio. May it live forever. KPFA 94.1 FM, Berkeley, California. I'll be back next week.